unusually high 3 liters of sweat per hour. But it's still impossible to get dangerously dehydrated in 20 minutes. Even if he'd been careless about drinking and started the race mildly dehydrated, the math of how much fluid he would have to lose in such a short time simply doesn't add up. In contrast, he was clearly dehydrated after the duel in the sun, and for good reason. He had been pushing himself for more than 2 hours. The 6 liters of IV fluid he received suggests he might have lost more than 13 pounds of sweat during the race. And yet, despite the sun and the excessive dehydration, he didn't suffer from heat stroke. Quite the opposite, in fact. In the medical tent immediately after the race, his body temperature was measured as 88 degrees, 10 degrees below normal. This measurement, which was recorded with an oral thermometer, stirred up a tempest among sports medicine doctors after the race. Since it wasn't a core temperature, measured in the rectum or ear, skeptics maintained that Salazar wasn't really hypothermic. Instead, they argued severe dehydration and the associated reduction in blood volume had compromised his body's ability to regulate temperature. William Castelli, the marathon's finish line medical director, moonlighting from his day job as director of the famously long-running Framingham Heart Study, stuck to his guns. His arms, hands, and head were cold, he said. His core may have been warm, but he was shivering and had goosebumps. As far as I'm concerned, he was freezing to death. Without a time machine and a rectal probe, it's impossible to settle the debate one way or the other. But we can rule out heat stroke. This seemingly contradictory pattern, heat stroke without dehydration, dehydration without heat stroke, is no fluke, it turns out. Dehydration is a greater concern in longer races because you have more time to sweat. Heat stroke, in contrast, is most common in shorter races. That's because your body temperature is primarily determined by your metabolic rate, that is, how hot your engine is running. In a 30-minute race, you can sustain a fast enough pace to drive your core temperature way up, even though you don't have time to get seriously dehydrated. In a 3-hour race, in most circumstances, you simply can't sustain a hard enough effort to push your temperature into heat stroke territory, even though you might get seriously dehydrated. It's true that, as early studies like the one Ambie Burfoot participated in showed, dehydration can push your temperature up a little bit. But the biggest factor dictating core temperature, aside from the weather conditions, is metabolic rate. That's why dehydration turned out to be a non-factor in Jason Stinson's trial. Max Gilpin wasn't dehydrated. But even if he was, it's highly unlikely that drinking more would have made a difference. Unfortunately for Salazar, this turned out to be true for him too. While preparing for the 1984 Los Angeles Olympics, where conditions for the marathon were expected to be hot and muggy, Salazar worked with a team of scientists at the U.S. Army Research Institute of Environmental Medicine in Natick, Massachusetts. They put him through heat tolerance tests in a climate chamber, ran blood tests, sent him to Florida with a do-it-yourself rectal thermometer for heat training, and had him drink a liter of water 5 minutes before the start of the Olympic marathon, plus almost 2 liters during the race itself, a stark contrast to the minimalist approach to hydration he had taken in his record-setting runs in New York and Boston. The result? America's greatest marathon hope struggled to a 15th-place finish, almost 5 minutes behind the winner and 6 minutes behind his own best time. More than 30 years after that race in 2016, I appeared as a guest on an NPR affiliate to talk about the science of hydration. One of the other guests was Lawrence Armstrong, the director of the University of Connecticut's Human Performance Lab, a former president of the American College of Sports Medicine, and the man who had led the U.S. Army team devising Salazar's hydration plan in 1984. It soon became clear that he and I had very different perspectives on the lessons to take from Salazar's experiences. Armstrong still maintained that inadequate hydration is a key risk factor for a heat stroke, and he was adamant that losing 2% of your body weight inevitably compromises your performance. But this claim, too, runs into problems when you venture outside the laboratory. On a damp September day in 2007, Ethiopian superstar Haile Gebrselassie surged to a new world record of 2 hours 4 minutes 26 seconds at the Berlin Marathon. Like Salazar, Gebrselassie sweats at a prodigious rate. In one lab test, he hit a rate of 3.6 liters per hour, which is among the highest ever recorded. By the end of his world record run, he had lost nearly 10% of his body weight, dropping from 128 to 115.5 pounds. Further, in-race measurements of Gebrselassie and other champion marathoners have produced similar results. There are two ways to interpret these data points. Either elite runners like Gebrselassie, whose world record made him the fastest human ever at the marathon distance, run slower than they should because they fail to adhere to the basic hydration advice doled out at every elementary school and fitness club in the world, or else that familiar advice is wrong. To my surprise, Armstrong took the former position on the radio show when I brought up the heavy sweat losses of top marathoners. And I asked, if they did not lose 10 pounds, how fast would they run? When I phoned him later to press him on this point, he offered a more nuanced take. During their pre-Olympic testing in 1984, he and his colleagues had estimated that Salazar's gastric emptying rate, which determines how much fluid can pass through the stomach for absorption from the small intestine, was about 1 liter per hour while running. Given that his sweat rate was 3 times higher than that, there was never any chance he would be able to limit his fluid loss to 2%. Drinking more would simply leave fluid sloshing around in his stomach without increasing hydration. And since gastric emptying rarely exceeds 1.3 liters per hour, the same is true for many people, meaning that in prolonged exercise in the heat, the 2% rule is more a theoretical idea than a realistic plan. Still, Armstrong was adamant that marathoners like Gebrselassie pay a price for the high levels of dehydration they incur. There is no doubt in my mind that he would run better and faster, no doubt, if he were down around 2% instead of 10%, he told me. It's tempting to dismiss Gebrselassie and Salazar as physiological anomalies, which they undoubtedly are, but similar patterns show up in much less rarefied samples. At marathons, triathlons, and cycling races around the world, researchers have tried a simple test. Weigh athletes before and after the race and look for a relationship between race finish and degree of dehydration. The results are consistently the opposite of what you would expect. The fastest finishers tend to be the most dehydrated. For example, among 643 finishers in the 2009 Mont-Saint-Michel Marathon in France, sub-3-hour finishers averaged a loss of 3.1% of their starting weight. Finishers between 3 and 4 hours averaged 2.5%, and those clocking more than 4 hours were the only ones to obey the 2% rule, losing an average 1.8%. The results don't prove that drinking makes you slower, but they certainly raise further questions about the claim that any loss greater than 2% slows you down. As for the relatively common sight of athletes needing assistance or even collapsing after the finish of a long race, there are several reasons to be suspicious of the idea that these athletes are paying the price for insufficient hydration. One is that studies have found no difference between the typical dehydration levels of collapsed athletes and those who walk away from the finish line untroubled. Another is that an estimated 85% of collapses take place shortly after crossing the finish line. This suggests that there is something about the act of stopping after prolonged exertion that triggers problems. If the cause was dehydration, You would expect to see more athletes crumpling to the pavement in the closing miles of the race rather than a few steps beyond the finish line. The problem, many researchers now believe, is a loss of blood pressure caused by blood pooling in the legs after you stop running or cycling. During exercise, your heart directs vast quantities of blood to the oxygen-starved muscles in the legs. With each step or pedal stroke, your calf muscles contract and squeeze the blood vessels in the lower leg, helping to mechanically pump this blood back toward the heart. After you cross the finish line, this muscle pump abruptly stops. And in some people, circulation doesn't readjust quickly enough to maintain their blood pressure, causing them to feel dizzy or collapse. The solution? At a series of Ironman triathlons and ultramarathons in South Africa in 2006 and 2007, medical staff randomized collapsed athletes to two possible treatments. Those with even-numbered race bibs were given intravenous fluids, which would be the ideal treatment if the underlying problem was dehydration. Those with odd-numbered bibs were simply told to lie down and elevate their legs and allowed to drink as desired. The average time to discharge from the medical tent for both groups was just under an hour, with no statistically significant difference between the two. How do we reconcile the chasm between the laboratory and real-world effects of dehydration? The first step is to make a distinction between thirst, which is the feeling that you would like to take a drink, and dehydration, which is the state of having lost fluids relative to your normal levels. The World War II era desert studies make this distinction clear. While being thirsty virtually always indicates that you're dehydrated, the concept of voluntary dehydration illustrates that. Conversely, being dehydrated won't always make you thirsty. But as Tim Noakes points out, nearly all dehydration studies since then have lumped the two together. Mountains of data now demonstrate that being dehydrated and thirsty, even at a relatively mild level, will slow you down. But what if you're in the state of voluntary dehydration, which by definition involves free access to fluids so that you're dehydrated but not thirsty? To answer that question, it's worth considering what thirst is for. The simplest explanation is that it's the body's way of ensuring that you keep your fluid levels topped up. In this picture, voluntary dehydration is a failure of the system. It indicates that your thirst sensation isn't very good at its job because it fails to notice that you're losing fluids. But physiologists have shown that this isn't how thirst works. Instead of monitoring fluid levels, your body monitors plasma osmolality, which is the concentration of small particles like sodium and other electrolytes in your blood. As you get dehydrated, your blood gets more concentrated, and your body responds by secreting an antidiuretic hormone that causes your kidneys to start reabsorbing water and by making you thirsty. Unlike your body's fluid levels, plasma osmolality is very tightly regulated. When you're looking at the right variable, your thirst sensation, along with other homeostatic mechanisms like antidiuretic hormone, doesn't make mistakes. This means that what looks like a potential problem, voluntary dehydration, may actually be completely normal from the body's perspective. In a 2011 study, 18 South African Special Forces soldiers undertook a 16-mile march, carrying 57-pound packs, including rifles and water supplies, in temperatures that peaked at 112 degrees Fahrenheit. The soldiers were permitted to drink as much water as they wanted, but, as expected, they nonetheless lost an average of 6 pounds, corresponding to 3.8% of their starting weight. Their plasma osmolality, in contrast, was essentially unchanged. From the perspective of the body's primary hydration sensor, they were just fine. This disconnect between thirst and water loss may actually be an evolutionary advantage rather than a bug. The born-to-run theory of human origins, advanced by evolutionary biologists Dennis Bramble and Daniel Lieberman in 2004, posits that our ability to run long distances over the hot savanna gave us a crucial advantage over other species. To do that, we needed to be able to tolerate temporary periods of dehydration without negative effects. Much as the San Bushman hunter Karoa Langwani did during a 2000 documentary when he hunted a kudu to exhaustion during a 20-mile chase through the Kalahari Desert. During 4 to 6 hours of hunting in temperatures well above 100 degrees, he drank only a liter of water. By adjusting the amount of salt in our sweat, we're able to keep plasma osmolality stable even as we lose water, for a while at least. Back at the campfire, after the hunt is over, we bring our water levels back to normal over the course of several hours. There's another twist that helps explain how we're able to tolerate seemingly extreme losses of water. In this discussion, we've been assuming that if you lose a pound of weight during exercise, that means you've lost a pound of water. But that's not necessarily the case. In the study of South African soldiers, the volunteers drank a dose of specially prepared tracer water before and after the march, in which some of the hydrogen atoms were replaced with deuterium atoms, hydrogen atoms with an extra neutron. This allowed the researchers to accurately measure how much the total amount of water in the body changed during the hike. The results showed that for every pound of weight lost, the amount of water circulating in the body dropped by only 0.2 pounds, a dramatic difference that helps explain why the soldiers didn't feel the need to drink more. Part of the explanation, according to the University of Cape Town researcher Nicholas Tam, is that not all the weight you lose is water. During prolonged exercise, you will use fat and you will use carbohydrate, he explains, and once you've burned it up, it's not there anymore. The chemical reactions involved in burning fat and carbohydrate produce two key byproducts, carbon dioxide, which you breathe out, and water, which actually adds to the amount of fluid available in your body. Even more significant, your body stores carbohydrate in your muscles in a form that locks away about 3 grams of water for every gram of carbohydrate. This water isn't available to contribute to essential cellular processes until you start unlocking the carbohydrate stores. So your body sees it as new water when it's released during exercise. For decades, these factors were assumed to be insignificantly small. But in 2007, British scientists at the University of Loughborough estimated that a marathoner could conceivably lose 1 to 3% of his or her body mass without any net loss of water. The study with South African soldiers seemed to confirm these estimates, as did a 2011 study by Tam that found no change in total body water content in runners at a half marathon, despite an average weight loss of more than 3 pounds. The effect is even more pronounced at longer distances. Data from the Western States 100-mile race suggests that typical finishers should expect to lose between 4.5 and 6.4% of their starting weight, just to keep their internal hydration levels steady. The result is that you can be dehydrated, at least in the sense that you've lost weight, without hurting your performance. What matters instead is how thirsty you are. Unfortunately, virtually all hydration studies since World War II have been designed in a way that makes it impossible to distinguish between dehydration and thirst. Consider, for example, the 1966 U.S. Army study described earlier, which found that being dehydrated by 2% caused a 22% decrease in time to exhaustion. To achieve this level of dehydration, the subjects had first walked to exhaustion on a treadmill, then spent 6 hours confined to a room at 115 degrees to promote sweating, all before even beginning their exercise test. Other studies have used diuretics to promote dehydration, and most forbid the subjects from drinking during the bout of exercise. It's not remotely surprising that endurance is reduced under these conditions. In addition to being dehydrated, the subjects are tired, thirsty, and probably pretty annoyed by the whole process. The more interesting comparison isn't between full hydration and no hydration. It's between drinking as much as you want, enough to abolish thirst, even though you'll still get voluntarily dehydrated, and drinking either more or less. That was the goal of a 2009 study at Noakes's lab in Cape Town, in which cyclists completed a series of 6 50-mile time trials. In the first trial, they drank as much as they wanted. In the other 5, they were assigned varying levels of hydration ranging from nothing to enough to fully replace all their sweat losses. Sure enough, being hydrated improved performance. In the 3 trials where the cyclists were forced to drink less than they'd chosen to in the first trial, they were slower than the 3 higher hydration trials. But there was no further improvement when they drank more than they had chosen to in the first trial. Avoiding thirst rather than avoiding dehydration seems to be the most important key to performance. This controversial claim was mostly dismissed when it was first published, but the debate has gradually shifted in the years since then. A 2013 meta-analysis in the British Journal of Sports Medicine concluded that any losses of less than 4% are very unlikely to impair endurance performance under real-world exercise conditions, and concluded that athletes should be encouraged to drink according to thirst. Still, as compelling as these lines of evidence are, focusing on the details of plasma osmolality and total body water misses a larger point that has recurred throughout this book. The importance of any underlying physiological signal depends in part on how your brain receives and interprets it. When you drink, you're also affecting your thirst, your perception, your psychology, your motivation, says Stephen Chung, the Brock University cyclist and environmental physiologist we met in the previous chapter. If you're stuck in an uncomfortable heat chamber and told you'll only be allowed to drink a few thimblefuls of water, your performance will likely suffer, whether you're dehydrated or not. To get around this problem, Chung decided to try hydrating a group of cyclists intravenously. The study was double-blinded, meaning that neither the subjects nor the researchers knew how dehydrated a cyclist was allowed to get during each ride. Instead, a paramedic hidden behind a curtain controlled how much, if any, saline solution was infused into their arms. The results showed that in a 20-kilometer time trial, following 90 minutes of steady riding in the heat, even 3% dehydration had no effect on performance. Other studies have shown that the mere act of swallowing fluids, a feeling the cyclists in Chung's study were denied, effectively fights thirst and improves performance. A famous 1997 study at Yale had subjects exercise for 2 hours to induce dehydration, then allowed them to drink, and monitored the changes in perceived thirst and antidiuretic hormone, the 2 key regulators of plasma osmolality. Then they repeated the trial, but inserted a tube down through the nose into the stomach to vacuum out the water as soon as it was swallowed. The result? Thirst and antidiuretic hormone secretion both decreased anyway, presumably in response to the sensation of water flowing down the throat. And when they reversed the experiment, sending the same amount of water down the nasogastric tube instead of letting the subjects swallow it, it was less effective in quenching thirst, even though the water was allowed to stay in their stomachs. This, in turn, helps to explain why a later study found that swallowing small mouthfuls of water, too small to make any difference to overall hydration levels, boosted exercise performance by 17%, compared to rinsing the same amount of water in the mouth and then spitting it out. When it comes to quenching your thirst perception, not just in your mouth, but in the cool flow of liquid down a parched throat, is, at least in part, reality. So, is dehydration really a vast corporate conspiracy whose effects are all in your head or throat? Not quite. In recent years, the debate about hydration has become increasingly polarized. Gadflies like Tim Noakes have at times seemed to argue that hydration doesn't matter at all. In his 2012 book, Waterlogged, he somewhat facetiously suggested that true dehydration in marathon runners should be diagnosed by the signs observed in a company of U.S. cavalrymen who got lost in the Texas desert in 1877. An uncontrollable desire for water, inability to detect the presence of fluid or food in the mouth, inability to masticate food, uncontrollable desire to ingest any fluid, even blood or urine. And that seems a little extreme. Meanwhile, respected establishment voices like Lawrence Armstrong continue to maintain that thirst is a completely inadequate guide to hydration, and that even the mildest loss of fluids will cause trouble. For a middle ground between these two perspectives, I've found that the physiologists who work with Olympic athletes are often best at reconciling abstract theory with the cold, hard practice of elite sport. Anyone who has worked in the field with athletes has probably realized years ago that a strict 2% dehydration cutoff just doesn't work, says Trent Stellingworth, a physiologist at the Canadian Sport Institute Pacific in Victoria, British Columbia. In his work with elite marathoners, Stellingworth aims for 3 to 6% dehydration, depending on weather and individual tolerance. Simply drinking to thirst doesn't cut it for elite marathoners because drinks are only available every 5K or so. And the jostling motion of fast running makes it difficult to drink as much as they would otherwise choose. Even Haile Gebrselassie, who set world records while losing 10% of his body weight, didn't rely on a drink-when-you-feel-like-it plan. That's what he tried in his very first marathon in 2002, when he pressed the pace early on but eventually blew up and was passed by rivals Khalid Kanouchi and Paul Turgot. In later and more successful marathons, he followed a carefully planned hydration strategy. During his 2007 world record race in Berlin, according to Stellingworth, Gebrselassie's plan involved a bottle of sports drink 3 hours before the race, another 1 hour before the race, and then a total of 2 liters of water and sports drink during the race, consumed at 5K intervals. He wasn't following the 2% rule, but he was certainly following a premeditated drinking plan. One final caveat is that our ability to tolerate temporary bouts of dehydration is, well, temporary. Marathoners can handle 10% dehydration for a few hours, but that assumes you're properly hydrated when you arrive at the start line, a factor that is, if anything, even more important than what you drink during exercise, according to Stephen Chung's research. And what if you're doing an Ironman triathlon or grueling multi-day ultra like the 60-hour Barkley marathons, far beyond the evolutionary template that presumably shaped our sense of thirst? The short answer is, we don't know. And in the absence of evidence, it makes sense to err on the side of caution and minimize dehydration, not just thirst, during extremely prolonged bouts of exercise. When I go for week-long backcountry hikes in the mountains, or for that matter 1 hour trail runs in the unpopulated desert parkland near my in-laws' place in Tucson, I know that the consequences of any errors are so severe that it's better to stay ahead of thirst. The overturning of conventional wisdom on hydration has been so rapid and confusing that you now hear people arguing that staying hydrated is actually bad. After all, the thinking goes, if Haile Gebrselassie loses 12 pounds during a marathon, it makes him that much lighter and faster. Some scientists have made similar arguments about cycling in the mountains, where the benefits of staying light might exceed the benefits of staying hydrated. I'm not convinced by these arguments. To me, the primary message is that, like oxygen and heat and, as we'll discover, fuel, the loss of fluids first makes itself felt via the brain. Thirst, not dehydration, increases your sense of perceived effort and in turn causes you to slow down. Eventually, the physiological consequences of dehydration assert themselves, increasing the strain on your cardiovascular system and pushing your core temperature up as the volume of blood in your arteries decreases. But that only happens if you've already ignored the signs of thirst. That means that hydration still matters. Stephen Chung, for example, still takes 2 full water bottles along on long bike rides, despite the results of his IV study. It's just not as imminent a crisis as we've been led to believe, and this finding has implications. Chung points to the disappointing performance of American cyclist Taylor Finney after he dropped a water bottle at the World Championships in 2013. The race was only an hour long, so it shouldn't have mattered. But since Finney believed it was a problem, it hurt his ride. That's the message Chung hopes people will take from his study and from the spate of recent research challenging hydration orthodoxy. Not that you shouldn't drink when you have the chance, but that you shouldn't obsess about it when you don't. It's one less psychological crutch, he says, to hold you back from a top performance. Chapter 10. Fuel. The meals themselves didn't seem that unusual. For breakfasts, Olympic race walker Evan Dunphy and his training partners would fill up on muesli with cream, or bacon and eggs. Lunches featured sandwiches with low-carb bread and lots of avocado. And dinners, specially prepared by the chefs at the Australian Institute of Sport and measured to the ounce for each athlete, ranged from almond satay or zucchini pasta to plain old pizza and burgers. This was the easy part of the diet. Before and during training was where things got weird, says Dunphy. Before a grueling 25-mile workout, he would fuel up with 2 boiled eggs and some nut balls. Nuts, cocoa, and I'm not sure what else to hold them together, he recalls. But they were all right. For mid-workout fueling instead of gels and sports drink, it was peanut butter cookies and cheese. The diet was a radical departure for Dunphy, a 25-year-old Canadian from Vancouver, and a risk. It was less than 9 months before the 2016 Olympics in Rio, where he hoped to contend for a medal. But elite race walkers are different. The event, which requires walking as quickly as possible while straightening your leg with each stride and keeping one foot on the ground at all times, is often the butt of jokes, both for its distinctive swivel-hipped stride and for its fundamental premise. NBC sports commentator Bob Costas famously compared it to a contest to see who can whisper the loudest. As a result, top race walkers from around the world form a notably cohesive clique, even though they're fierce rivals on the tarmac. This is largely forced upon us, Dunphy says, as we're usually the most marginalized of all event groups. Still, it meant that Dunphy was receptive when Australian walker Jared Tallant, the defending Olympic champion in the 50-kilometer event, approached him about the possibility of skipping the boreal winter and instead flying south to train in Australia, where he would take part in an unprecedented study of a radical sports nutrition scheme that was generating buzz and controversy in equal measures. Low-carbohydrate, high-fat, or LCHF diets. The LCHF debate, which has been roiling the weight loss world since the early 2000s, had recently made the leap to endurance sport. At first, it was a few maverick scientists and would-be gurus, then some long-haired, dogma-defying ultra-runners, then suddenly, Tim Noakes himself, author of the most influential running book of all time, embraced the cause with his customary fervor. For 33 years, I followed and advocated through my book, Lore of Running, the current dogma that to be active and healthy, one must eat a diet low in fat and high in carbohydrate, he wrote in 2015. I now believe that this advice was quite wrong. I apologize, it was an honest error. In Canberra, the staid government town where the Australian Institute of Sports' manicured playing fields and high-tech labs are located, Dunphy and Talent were joined by 19 other world-class racewalkers from 5 different continents for the LCHF study, codenamed Supernova. While in residence at the AIS, the walkers followed a standardized training plan, and for periods of 3 weeks at a time, they adhered to strictly controlled diets that either followed conventional sports nutrition advice for endurance athletes, 60 to 65% of calories from carbohydrate, 15 to 20% from protein, and 20% from fat, or an extreme LCHF diet, 75 to 80% fat, 15 to 20% protein, and less than 50 grams per day of carbohydrate, the equivalent of 2 small bananas. Before and after the 3-week diets, the athletes gave samples of blood and poop, completed a series of treadmill tests in the lab, and put their hard-earned fitness to the only test that really matters, a race. For Dunphy, the transition to LCHF was rocky. In his first fully carb-free workout, what should have been an easy 30-kilometer walk in 2.5 hours turned into a death march, and he actually collapsed at the finish. Later that week, he set an all-time personal worst with his slowest 10-kilometer walk ever. Subsequent weeks went a little better, but his heart rate was consistently higher than usual during training, and so was his sense of effort. At the end of 3 weeks, lab testing showed that he was measurably less efficient, and he was slower in his 10-kilometer race. Overall, the results seemed disappointing. So it was with a palpable sense of relief that he resumed his standard high-carbohydrate diet. Almost immediately, he felt better and began crushing his workouts. Just 10 days later, he headed to Melbourne for a race, where, to everyone's surprise, he shattered the Canadian 50-kilometer walk record with a time of 3 hours, 43 minutes, 45 seconds, establishing himself as a podium contender for Rio. When your car runs out of gas, it stops. In a very simplified sense, your body behaves in the same way. The fuel you use is supplied by food, which contains energy stored in the form of chemical bonds between atoms. Those bonds are broken as the food is metabolized, releasing energy that powers your muscles and other organs. If you completely run out of food energy, of course, a bad race is the least of your worries. The records for longest survival without food are both grim and confusing, depending on the precise circumstances and the trustworthiness of the witnesses. A frequently cited benchmark is Kieran Daugherty, an Irish Republican Army prisoner at the infamous Mays Prison near Belfast, who refused food for 73 days in 1981 before dying. If you bend the rules a bit to allow vitamins in addition to water, then you'll be able to continue accessing your body's fat stores for much longer. A 1973 journal article by a Scottish doctor reports the case of A.B., a 27-year-old man who weighed 456 pounds before undertaking a medically supervised fast lasting 382 days, during which he lost a remarkable 276 pounds. Such feats show that no matter how badly you bonk during your Ironman, your gas tank isn't truly empty. In fact, performance starts declining long before the needle hits E, for reasons that aren't always obvious. In one study that launched 1,000 maternal I told you so's, British researchers found that skipping breakfast resulted in a 4.5% drop in 30-minute cycling time trial performance at 5 p.m. that afternoon, even though the subjects had been allowed to eat as much as they wanted at lunch. On a longer time scale, researchers at the University of Minnesota put 36 men, all conscientious objectors who had chosen alternative forms of service during World War II, through a 12-week period of semi-starvation, during which their daily calorie intake was cut in half, and they lost roughly a quarter of their body weight. Their endurance, measured by an uphill treadmill test to exhaustion with two technicians positioned behind the machine to catch their crumpled bodies, dropped by 72% by the end of the experiment. One man lasted just 19 seconds in the final treadmill test. It's not just how much fuel is in the tank, in other words. Endurance performance also depends on what types of fuel you have available, where it's stored, and how quickly you can access it. The three basic fuel options are protein, carbohydrate, and fat. While protein is important for building and repairing muscles after resistance exercise, it plays a negligible role in directly fueling muscle contractions. That said, when you're running low on other sources of fuel during an extended effort, protein can contribute up to 10% of your fuel needs, which means that, contrary to popular dogma, even skinny endurance athletes do need more protein than the average non-athlete. For the most part, though, carbohydrate and fat stoke the furnace during prolonged exercise, and their relative importance has been debated for more than a century. Early experiments in the first half of the 20th century showed that the balance between fat and carbohydrate use depends on how hard you're working. During easy exercise, like a gentle walk, you burn mostly fat from the supplies circulating in your bloodstream. As you speed up, you begin to add more carbohydrate to the mix, and by the time you're panting heavily, the proportions have flipped, and you're burning mostly carbohydrate. The precise blend depends on a variety of factors. The fitter you are, for example, the greater the proportion of fat you burn at any given speed. That's simply because maintaining a given speed gets easier as you get fitter. As John Hawley, an exercise metabolism researcher at Australian Catholic University, points out, no matter how fit you are, you'll burn the same fat-carb mix at any given relative intensity. Eating a diet high in either fat or carbohydrate also tilts your preferred fuel mix in that direction. But even taking these factors into account, carbohydrates dominate for any intense exercise. One study found that over the marathon distance, running at 2:45 pace relied on 97% carbohydrate fuel, while slowing down to 3:45 pace reduced the carbohydrate mix to 68%. The cliche of the pasta-fueled marathoner can be traced back to the work of Swedish scientists Jonas Bergström and Erik Hultman in the 1960s. Bergström pioneered the use of needle biopsies, a technique that allowed researchers to slice out small pieces of muscle from their long-suffering research volunteers, or, as was the habit in Scandinavian labs at the time, from their own muscles. In one notable study, Bergström and Hultman sat on opposite sides of a stationary bike, each pedaling with one leg while the other rested, until they were both too exhausted to continue. Self-inflicted muscle biopsies before and after cycling showed that levels of glycogen, the form in which carbohydrate is stored in muscles, had dropped to zero in the exercised leg. Running out of this specific muscle fuel, in other words, seemed to coincide with exhaustion. Over the next 3 days, the two men ate a high-carbohydrate diet and performed regular biopsies. Glycogen levels stayed roughly constant in their rested legs, but in the exercised legs, levels shot up to twice their initial value, a supercompensation effect that launched the idea of carbohydrate loading before long-distance races. Subsequent biopsy studies confirmed that the amount of glycogen you can stuff into your muscles is a pretty good predictor of how long you'll last on a treadmill or stationary bike test to exhaustion. There are other sources of carbohydrate in the body. Your liver, for example, can store 400 or 500 calories of glycogen for use throughout the body, compared to about 2,000 for fully loaded leg muscles. That's why it's useful to eat a small breakfast a few hours before a morning marathon. While your muscles remain fully stocked, your liver glycogen gets depleted because it fuels your energy-hungry brain while you sleep. Your muscles can also dip into the glucose circulating in your blood, though the total amount of glucose in circulation at any given moment is very small. Overall, the picture that emerged from these studies is relatively simple, harking back to A.V. Hill's human body as a machine view. You can store a finite amount of carbohydrate fuel in your body, and when you use it up, you bonk. If that's the case, then it makes sense for endurance athletes to stock up on carbohydrates as much as possible. And that, more or less, is what sports nutritionists have been advocating since the 1970s. Keep your glycogen levels high by consuming a diet that gets 60 to 65% of its calories from carbohydrate. Top up your stores by carbo-loading in the final few days before a competition, and in events lasting longer than about 90 minutes, eat or drink some easily digested carbohydrates to supplement your stored glycogen, which will otherwise run out. Modern sports nutrition guidelines, Hawley points out, actually recommend a daily target amount of carbohydrate per pound of total body weight based on the type of training you've done that day, rather than overall percentage targets. This helps account for the considerable differences between the needs of, say, an elfin distance runner and a heavyweight rower. Empirically speaking, this advice seems to work pretty well. One study found that Kenyan runners who currently hold 60 of the top 100 men's marathon times in history typically get 76.5% of their calories from carbohydrate, including 23% from ugali, a sticky and stomach-filling cornmeal mash, and 20% from the copious spoonfuls of sugar they heap into their tea and porridge. Another 35 times on the top 100 list are held by Ethiopians. A similar study found that they get 64.3% of their calories from carbohydrate, with the biggest contribution from injera, a sourdough flatbread made from a local grain called teff. If there's an alternative diet plan that's better for endurance performance, no one has told the best endurance athletes in the world. On April 1, 1879, Frederick Schwatka and his companions set out across the Arctic tundra from their camp on the northwestern shores of Hudson Bay. Schwatka had been sent north by the American Geographical Society to search for traces of the Lost Franklin expedition, which had disappeared 3 decades earlier while searching for the Northwest Passage, with the presumed loss of 129 men. Schwatka's team, in contrast, was tiny. He had just 3 companions, and they hired an Inuit guide and 3 sled drivers, along with their wives and children, to accompany them. The group set off with 3 sleds, pulled by 44 dogs, weighed down by nearly 4,000 pounds of walrus meat for the dogs, plus bundles of hard bread, pork, corned beef, and other supplies. In total, the rations were expected to last for about a month. By the time they returned to their base camp, 11 months and 20 days later, they had covered a record-setting 3,251 miles by sled, while enduring temperatures that over 1 3-month period averaged minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit, located some telling remains of Franklin's expedition, including further evidence that some of the men had resorted to cannibalism, discovered new rivers and other geographical features, and suffered not a single casualty. Much as, a century later, the nimble Alpine-style ascents of Reinhold Messner represented a break from the cumbersome military-style expeditions that were then standard in mountaineering, Schwatka's trip helped to usher in a new style of exploration. Franklin's epic debacle was by no means an isolated incident. Across the globe, European explorers were trying to bulldoze their way into remote and unfamiliar environments with spectacularly inappropriate equipment and ill-considered plans. In Australia, for example, the Burke and Wills expedition of 1860 set off into the country's arid interior at the height of summer, with 23 horses and 26 camels toting a ridiculous load, including a Chinese gong, a stationary cabinet, and a heavy wooden table with matching stools. Like Franklin, Burke and Wills ended up dying of starvation in a region that, to those who lived there, seemed abundantly supplied with food. Schwatka had no experience in the Arctic, but he was a careful and capable leader who had gained respect for the traditional knowledge of native people during his service as a cavalry officer in the American West. While in the army, he also managed to find time to qualify as both a lawyer and, a year later, a doctor. And he possesses a very important adjunct, though to the uninitiated it may seem trifling, one of his tripmates reported. A stomach that can relish and digest fat. Schwatka's decision to carry only a month of food meant that he and his companions would have to live off the land as the Inuit in the region did. That meant a diet that, for much of the year, consisted of nothing but fish and meat, a sure recipe, you would think, for diseases of deficiency, like scurvy, and for a general lack of carbohydrate-powered energy for physical exertion. In the end, the men killed and ate a total of 522 reindeer during their trip, plus muskoxen, polar bears, and seals. For 1 2-week period, they ate nothing but ducks. Adapting to the diet took time. When first thrown wholly upon the diet of reindeer meat, it seems inadequate to properly nourish the system, and there is an apparent weakness and inability to perform severe, exertive, fatiguing journeys, Schwatka noted in his diary. But this soon passes away in the course of 2 to 3 weeks. After close to a year of rigorous travel on this diet, he was as fit as ever, capable of walking 65 miles in 2 days to meet the whaling ship that would take him home. Schwatka's adventure should have debunked once and for all the myth that the Inuit had some unique evolutionary powers that enabled them to survive for much of the year on meat alone. But that aspect of his journey was mostly overlooked, until a later explorer and anthropologist, Vilhelmur Stefansson, reached similar conclusions in the early 1900s. Stefansson left a post at Harvard to join an expedition to the Arctic, where through a series of mishaps he found himself stranded for the winter, alone with a group of Inuit forced to rely on their hospitality and on their diet, which consisted of raw, half-frozen fish for breakfast and lunch, and boiled fish for dinner. Stefansson didn't even like fish, but out of necessity, he soon adapted. He eventually ventured to try the rotten fish kept from the previous summer, which was considered a special delicacy, and to his surprise, liked it better than my first taste of camembert. In subsequent expeditions, Stefansson insisted that he and his men eat Inuit style, and he spent a total of more than 5 years living on fish, meat, and water. His dietary claims were so controversial that he and a fellow explorer eventually agreed to spend a year living on an all-meat diet in New York under close medical supervision, funded by the Institute of American Meatpackers. The results, which were published in 1930 in the Journal of Biological Chemistry, generally supported his claims of good health. Neither man developed scurvy, thanks to the vitamin C contained in animal organs and other cuts. Stephenson's worst moments came at the start of the experiment, when the investigators fed him only lean meat. In the Arctic, he had noted, the Inuit relished the fattiest parts of the animal, giving the leanest meat to the dogs. Once he switched to fattier cuts, so that about three-quarters of his calories came from fat, he was fine. Every few weeks, the two explorers were led on a run around the Central Park Reservoir and then subjected to a series of tests to assess their stamina, which appeared to improve as the experiment wore on. Proving that you can survive on meat alone, as remarkable as that still seems, is different than proving it's a superior diet, and in particular that it enhances endurance. Stephenson continued to advocate for the benefits of a high-fat meat diet, including suggesting during World War II that troops should be outfitted with emergency rations of pemmican, a hearty mix of dried meat and rendered fat that native Canadians and northern explorers had relied on for generations. But when the proposal was put to the test by a platoon of seasoned troops during a simulated subarctic combat mission, the results, published in 1945 in the journal War Medicine, were disastrous. Morale fell abruptly on the first day of pemmican diet, and by the second day, excessive fatigue, weakness, and nausea appeared. On the third day, the platoon had deteriorated beyond the point of military usefulness. Vomiting and exhaustion compelled the officers in charge to terminate the test. This failure, combined with other studies that found superior endurance on high-carbohydrate diets compared to low-carbohydrate diets, helped put LCHF on the back burner for athletes and scientists. There were some caveats, though, as a medical researcher at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology named Stephen Finney pointed out in 1983. For one thing, as Schwatka had found, it takes several weeks for the body to adjust to a mostly carbohydrate-free diet, longer than any of the failed studies had allowed. The studies also didn't ensure adequate salt intake, which Finney believed was crucial, and they sometimes conflated high fat with high protein. While most of us intuitively think of an all-meat diet as being high in protein, an ounce of fat contains more than twice as many calories as an ounce of protein. Finney put five well-trained cyclists on a diet modeled after Stephenson's, with 83% of the calories from fat, 15% from protein, and just 2% from carbohydrate for 4 weeks. The results, which have acquired near scriptural status in the LCHF community, showed that the cyclists' VO2 max and performance in a multi-hour time-to-exhaustion test remained essentially unchanged. In other words, with enough adaptation time, you could, apparently, run your engine on fat just as well as it runs on carbohydrate. For sports scientists, this was an enticing prospect. As we've seen, a well-prepared athlete might be able to store 2,500 calories of carbohydrate. Running a marathon for a 150-pound runner takes around 3,000 calories, most of which will come from carbohydrate if you're racing as fast as you can. That means you either need to refuel along the route, which carries its own set of challenges, or slow down. Meanwhile, whether you like it or not, you're lugging at least 30,000, and for most of us, closer to 100,000, calories of fat with you. If, like Finney's cyclists, you could access those fat stores while exercising at a moderately high intensity, you could keep going long enough that sleep deprivation would be a bigger problem than bonking. In practice, though, there were some important caveats. With just five subjects, Finney's results were highly variable. One subject improved his time to exhaustion from 148 to 232 minutes, while another declined from 140 to 89 minutes. And there was a crucial trade-off, Finney acknowledged. In exchange for their enhanced ability to burn fat, The cyclists seem to have lost some of their ability to harness quick-burning carbohydrate for short sprints, resulting in a severe restriction on the ability of subjects to do anaerobic work. Over the next few decades, as sports scientists around the world experimented with various fat adaptation protocols, they ran into this